I'm Tess Vigeland. President Barack Obama had a lot to do this week, deciding where to hang that autographed poster of Aretha, drawing up policies to fulfill those big inaugural promises.
And we will act not only to create new jobs, but to lay a new foundation for growth.
We'll look at what the new administration could mean for our wallets. Plus, recognize this.
The Dow fell below 8,000 with a 330-point drop.
You hear the numbers daily on Marketplace, but what do those stock market points mean for investors? Our decoder comes to the rescue. And how do you spot a DIY disaster? Follow your nose.
Once it gets to the point where it starts to smell funny, there's no amount of money that can fix that.
That story and more coming up as we continue our coverage of fallout from the financial crisis on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Happy National Thrift Week. Are you keeping your spending in check? Well, the government isn't. It's stuffing more millions and billions into bank vaults. And for pretty good reason, the entire banking system is back on the brink. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com/new offers.
Remember that huge federal bailout package from a few months back? Yeah, fat lot of good that did. Shares of Bank of America have fallen to the $5 range. Citigroup is hovering around $3. Both are down more than 50% just this year, all 3 weeks of it. The Treasury Department is set to release the second half of the bailout money soon, but at this point, why bother? What's another $350 billion going to do that the first $350 didn't? Well, we're going to put that question now to Marketplace's senior business correspondent, Bob Moon. Welcome back to the show once again, Bob.
You always call me in here for the bad news, Tess.
Well, is there anything but that these days?
That's the problem.
All right, let's talk about what is going on with the banking system. Wasn't all of this supposed to be fixed, what, 3-4 months ago?
It was, and then we got all those bad earnings reports out of the banks again, particularly with the Bank of America thing, where they didn't have enough money to complete the Merrill Lynch purchase. They go back to the government and say, we need another $20 billion. Well, investors start wondering, well, what else is hiding in all those arranged marriages that we saw, J.P. Morgan Chase taking over Washington Mutual and Wells Fargo merging with Wachovia, that sort of thing. And they began to wonder, and bank stocks started to tank this past week.
What happened to the $350 billion that's already gone into the coffers?
All the money we've spent so far?
Yeah.
This is what you've got to show for it. Now, for the sake of this conversation, let's start thinking in terms of these patients that are under intensive care. They've got gaping wounds, and we've been pumping the blood into them, trying to keep them alive, trying to get them stabilized so we can close those wounds, let's say. Then we have a problem with these opportunistic infections that have started sweeping through the hospital. Let's call that the recession. In this case, it's a lot like a staph infection. So even those patients that came into the hospital in fairly good shape are now facing these other problems. It's beginning to spread to them as well. The argument can be made that if we had not been pumping the blood into these patients,
the $350 billion.
That's right. That things would be a lot worse now. So you can at least take that to the bank, if you will.
If $350 billion didn't do it, perhaps another $350 billion, which is what we're waiting for now, won't do it as well. So what possible solution is there to sew up the banks and get them off the gurney?
Well, to stretch this metaphor even more, this is sort of like triage. You have to set your priorities here. And as a last resort, what a lot of people have been talking about is this word you've probably heard lately, nationalization, nationalize the banks.
What does that mean?
That would very simply be, as I say, a last resort of the government taking over the banks. Uncle Sam would run them. This has worked in the past in some cases. Sweden, for example, nationalized its banks on a much smaller scale than we're talking about in the U.S., and it did work. Then they sold them off into private hands again. We saw during the S&L crisis a couple of decades ago a similar thing where the government took over hundreds of institutions, basically nursed them back to health, and sold off the bad assets, that sort of thing. So it has worked to some degree in the past.
How would the consumer see that happen? I mean, for example, do you keep your FDIC insurance if the bank is nationalized? Does the statement come from Barack Obama or Tim Geithner, the new Treasury Secretary?
Well, first off, the FDIC would indeed still continue to insure your deposits. Through the end of this year, $250,000 per deposit would be insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. We're seeing the possibility, in this case, let's say, of less customer service. You might see the banks trying to cut corners in some areas. You might see fewer branches being open, that sort of thing, while the government whipped them into shape.
Okay, but your money is safe.
That's correct. Stockholders, however, that would be a totally different question.
Out of luck.
Out of luck. Stockholders, whenever banks have been nationalized, their proceeds have been wiped out.
Marketplace's Bob Moon joining us once again, as he has been throughout this financial crisis. Thanks so much. And I'm going to lay good money that we're going to talk to you again.
I think probably so. This story is going to be around for a while.
Thanks, Bob.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com/new offers. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
This week, the Obama administration stepped up calls for an $825 billion stimulus package. Banks are far from the only worry. There's unemployment, health care, taxes, all things that President Obama has pledged to fix. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is in the nation's capital. And Nancy, let's take a look at some of the personal finance issues that might be on the table in the near future. Let's start with taxes.
Well, Tess, everybody hates tax time, but there is a little bit of good news for college kids in the economic stimulus package. The House and the Senate are both considering a temporary $2,500 tax credit to help pay for college. President Obama is even a little more ambitious than that. He actually wants a college tuition tax credit for middle-class students. They would get $4,000, and in exchange, they would perform 100 hours of community service.
One other tax issue that just keeps coming around every single year is the alternative minimum tax. We've seen patches for this in years past. Any talk of that happening again this year?
Yeah, actually, Democrats say they may try to include a patch in the stimulus package. Some deficit hawks don't like this idea of adding the patch to the stimulus proposal because they don't want anything in there that doesn't actually stimulate the economy by producing jobs.
One issue that came up a lot on the campaign trail before the election was the notion of a tax cut for certain taxpayers. What's the word on that and how might that work?
Yeah, and those certain taxpayers, Tess, would include you and me. Most of us earn less than $200,000 a year, and that's what this tax cut is aimed at. Those folks would get a $500 tax credit, and couples in that tax bracket would get a $1,000 credit. And the way it would work is the payroll taxes that are automatically deducted from our paychecks would be lowered. So we wouldn't get a check in the mail, but we would hopefully see that our paychecks were a bit fatter and go out and spend that money right away and stimulate the economy.
Well, I'll definitely look forward to that possibility. And what about, again, this was an issue on the campaign, the notion of rolling back or repealing the Bush administration tax cuts?
Yeah, President Obama has talked about that. He said he was going to repeal the Bush tax cuts for people making more than $250,000. He has backed off of that pledge a little bit, but the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, may hold him to it.
Nancy, President Obama had a lot of ideas about improving health care while he was on the campaign trail. What's he got up his sleeve on that issue?
Yeah, he wants to require insurance companies to cover pre-existing medical conditions. The new White House also is supporting a tax credit for small businesses. That's intended to help them provide health insurance for their workers through a pool that President Obama is calling the National Health Insurance Exchange.
And finally, unemployment just keeps going up and up and up in this country. We're up over 7%. What does the administration want to do about all the folks who are losing their jobs?
Yeah, President Obama has included that in his economic stimulus package as well. And the House is considering a plan that would increase unemployment checks by about $25 a week. And Tess, on the subject of food stamps, the House Appropriations Committee has agreed to increase food stamp funding by about $150 million. So the House Democrats and the Obama administration are moving ahead on both of those fronts.
All right. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer joining us from our Washington, D.C. bureau. Thanks so much, Nancy.
You're welcome.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And with me, as always, is our own economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
So we just heard from Nancy Marshall-Genzer about what we can expect, perhaps, from the Obama administration over the next 6 months or so in terms of personal finance. I wanted to get your thoughts on some of the events of this week, some of the things that President Obama said in his inaugural speech. And let's play a quick clip of one part of that.
Starting today, we must pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America.
This could mean all kinds of things, but when it comes to personal finance, how can we apply this?
Oh, I think it's a call to bringing your household finances in order. I mean, all of us are feeling the pressure to save more, reduce our borrowing. But the things that you're doing today, let's turn them into habits so that when the good times come, and there will be good times, that your household, it will grow, its balance sheet will be strong, and so that when we do have another downturn, when we do have another bear market, no one likes that, but you'll be prepared financially, good times and bad, and that's a radical call.
It is a radical call, and when we talk about picking ourselves up and dusting ourselves off, you know, that call from President Obama came on a day where the Dow lost another 350 points, and we went under the 8,000 mark on the Dow for the first time in months. It's hard to conceive of how we can pick ourselves up now when we're still in the middle of this massive financial crisis.
All right. Well, I don't know if this is going to be reassuring or not for you, Tess, but Ronald Reagan gave a very powerful inaugural address, and the Dow went down. The fact that you have a new president doesn't end the crisis, doesn't end the downward momentum, but it shifts the dynamic and is not going to turn around the recession, but it's planting the seeds of recovery.
Let's hear another clip from President Obama where it sounds like I think he's asking us all to kind of get off the dime.
For everywhere we look, there is work to be done. The state of our economy calls for action, bold and swift, and we will act. Not only to create new jobs, but to lay a new foundation for growth.
Great idea. How likely is this all to really happen? We've been hearing about healthcare reform for as long as I can remember. Well, you know, we've been hearing about unemployment insurance reform. You think we are going to get off the dime this time?
I do. Now, there's a little bit of a yin and yang going on. Your skepticism and my optimism. But I want to give an example. 1935 Social Security Act. For years and years, there had been agitation by political reformers that there was a need to give the elderly financial security. And, you know, there's a little bit was done here and a couple of states there, but basically it didn't happen. Then we had a Great Depression. 1935, the law was passed. I don't think we're going to have a Great Depression, but I think enough people are suffering that what we're going to see in 2009 is healthcare reform. There's a prospect, there's a good possibility that that will happen.
On that upbeat note, which is always the way I like to end things, thanks so much, Chris, and we'll talk to you later on with Getting Personal.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
If you're a stay-at-home spouse, you could clip more coupons to help the family bottom line, or you could start your own business.
Rather than just waiting to see if this economy's going to turn around, are you going to get the bonus off your husband's company?
Mompreneurs. Plus, what's the point of stock market points? Coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. The Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act won Senate approval on Thursday and now heads to President Obama's desk for a signature. The bill reverses a recent Supreme Court ruling that said workers have to file claims for pay discrimination within 180 days of the discrimination happening. Women's groups fought for the legislation as part of a broader effort to close the wage gap. Meantime, more and more women are starting their own businesses. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports from the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting on so-called mompreneurs.
If there's a typical mompreneur out there, Mo Lynch Vashel probably fits the bill. She has two children at home and a $700 preschool bill to pay, not to mention ballet lessons. As the economy tanked over the last year, anxiety was rising.
Like everyone, things started to get a little tight around our home, and we were hitting the equity line every month just to pay our basic bills. So we weren't saving for taxes. Things were getting quite stressful, and I could see the stress on my husband's face, and I wanted to fix it.
Before the kids and the nice house in a suburb east of Oakland, California came along, Vashel trained guide dogs for the blind. She figured she could turn her skill to profit. Meet Scooter and Bailey, two of her current clients.
With Scooter and Bailey, adventure walking, baths, and maybe some eventual training with for collar response and for just ease of walking for the owners, and makes it more fun for everyone to get the dogs out.
Several months ago, Vashel founded Diablo Doggies. She runs the business out of her garage, offering obedience courses, canine spa treatments, dog walking, and watching. She says she's making money around $1,200 a month. Not huge, but a big help paying the bills right now.
It's taking control of what's going on in your own family and your own destiny, rather than just waiting to see if this economy's going to turn around. Are you going to get the bonus off your husband's company? And, you know, worrying that your husband may be let go. It's getting in there and hedging the bet that if something did happen, well, great, I've already got this up and running.
As editor of Entrepreneur magazine, Riva Lazansky tracked a generation of so-called mompreneurs taking charge of their destinies. She now blogs for MSN Office Live.
It's not so much, you know, that you can have it all kind of concept that they try to throw on women in the 90s. It's you can have it all when you want it. So you want to have a kid. Most people need two incomes today. And technology today has enabled you to literally sit in your kitchen or in a spare room or wherever you want and run a business. So why not do it?
Lazansky says the most successful of these ventures launch out of the maternal consumer experience, whether it's in personal organizers or fashion accessories or diapers, and market to the childbearing female demographic. She says starting a business at home is perfect for mothers who want to take care of their kids and make money, but she does have a bone to pick with the mompreneur label.
You take the word entrepreneur, it conjures up someone who is aggressive and ambitious and really wants to grow their business. And then you preface it with mom, and it makes it sound like you want to just sort of sit in your kitchen and do something part-time.
For one thing, says Lazansky, startups are time-consuming, and when done right, all-consuming, which is a good description of Kimberly Graham Nye's business. She found a flushable and compostable diaper when she had her first child. 6 years later, she's licensed the technology and taken it global. G diapers are now found in more than 1,000 stores. The company's got a staff of 20, and it even provides free daycare to employees. Graham Nye has the branding statement down.
G diaper is really the new earth-friendly hybrid. It's the third choice in diapers. It's not a cloth, it's not a disposable, it's a totally new way to think about diapers.
Google biodegradable diapers and you'll find an intense debate about just how green they are. G diaper has jumped on the buzz in the blogosphere with thousands of evangelical customers who post regularly to parenting websites. Graham Nye says women-oriented online social networks are crucial for building market share.
Mothers talk, and mothers really believe in the power of a recommendation from another parent. Even if I don't know you well enough, if you're putting your stamp of approval on it, whether it be a baby carrier or a diaper or a nanny, whatever it might be, I'll trust you.
Back at her home/doggy spa in the Bay Area, Mo Lynch Vashel is using many of these mompreneurial marketing strategies. With Diablo Doggies, she's targeting new moms who are neglecting their canine kids in favor of their new human ones. She has this advice for women in her situation.
If you're in an industry and you have some background but are in an industry that might be dying, that you got to look ahead to see what's going to be the next thing, getting off the sinking ship before you get the pink slip.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
Get out!
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com/new offers. and by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
I mentioned earlier in the show that the Dow fell 300-plus points on Inauguration Day. Well, the next day, it recovered a good chunk of those losses. But if you ever wondered what exactly we mean when we talk about points on the Dow or the S&P or the NASDAQ, Ashley Milne-Tite is here to help with the Marketplace Decoder.
The term point reaches far into the financial past. Art Hogan is chief market analyst at Jefferies & Company.
Points have been being used since the first trading started, you know, under a beechwood tree at the end of Wall Street.
In the case of individual stocks, it's simple. 1 point equals $1. But what about when traders and journalists talk about stock market indices like the Dow Jones Industrial Average or the NASDAQ?
The Dow fell below 8,000 with a 330-point drop, about 4%.
Working out how many points an index is worth when the market goes up and down is a bit more complicated. Charles Jones is a professor of finance at Columbia Business School.
What they do is they add up all the prices of the Dow Jones stocks, just add those 30 prices together, and then they divide by a divisor
to get the final tally. In the old days, the people who managed the indices would simply tot up those prices and then divide by the number of stocks. These days, because of stock splits and companies moving in and out of the index, they divide by a carefully calculated fraction. Art Hogan says if you think about the Dow as a big layer cake and a point as a slice,
it would actually be a beautiful cake, I think, you know, with 30 different layers. And unfortunately, we've taken more slices out of it than we put onto it in the last couple of years.
In other words, that market's shed far more points than it's gained lately. And because the Dow only holds 30 stocks, a sharp movement in one or two can make for some dramatic swings. Charles Jones says because of its relatively narrow spectrum of stocks, the Dow's not the best indicator of how markets are doing.
Well, it was originally just industrials. It has broadened a little bit, but it still doesn't really include transportation companies. It's underweighted in financials, for instance. So you don't really get the full picture.
Jones says the S&P 500 contains, well, 500 stocks, so its layer cake would be much more colorful, and it's a much better indicator of the market's health. Jones says a point on the S&P is very different from a point on the Dow. When I spoke to him a few weeks ago, he said,
the S&P is at about 900 right now. The Dow Jones is at about 9,000. 9 points on the S&P is a full percent. 9 points on the Dow, well, that's a tenth of a percent, and nothing to get excited about.
What would be worth getting excited about, of course, would be the sight of those points heading steadily upwards. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
Get up!
It's time for Getting Personal, when we take your personal finance calls and questions. And with me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
Let's go right to the phones. And we've got Nadine on the line from Boise, Idaho. Hi, Nadine.
Hi.
What do you do there in Idaho?
I'm a teacher here in the Boise School District.
What ages?
I teach a third and fourth grade combination class.
How long have you been teaching?
15 years.
Well, terrific. What question can we answer for you today?
Well, I know I'm in the same boat with everybody else, but I'm really concerned about how much my mutual funds have dropped. I was wondering if I wouldn't be better off to sell some of them and just use that money to prepay my mortgage. I feel like I'm losing principal and interest in my mutual funds, and if I were paying my mortgage, I would be reducing that and saving money, actually.
Well, Chris, I wonder, do we have a repetitive lesson here on the non-virtues of buying high and selling low? You sell now, you lock in your losses, right?
Yeah, that'd be one of my problems, is you're just locking the losses. These are non-retirement mutual funds, right?
Right.
What are these mutual funds for, Nadine? Is that just a place to park your savings?
Well, more than that, I was hoping that would be in addition to my other retirement funds.
So how far away from retirement are you?
9 years.
9 years. Okay. Well, Chris, that probably makes a difference, huh?
Well, you still have a fair amount of time on your side. And then if you think about it, just thinking about how long we're living today and how active we are in what we're calling our retirement years or our golden years, it might be that you have 15, 20 years before you need to tap the money. And I think it's great that you have it. But as Tess was saying earlier, and I would just echo her comment, I wouldn't lock in my losses. The question I'd be asking is, would you want to try and put a little bit of extra money toward principal going forward into your mortgage if that's going to make you feel better, but not use the money from these mutual funds?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, Nadine, I wonder your thoughts about, you know, what Chris has said here, which is that even though you are technically 9 years from retirement, retirement doesn't like begin and end at 65 or whenever you actually retire. You have a long ways after that to potentially recover these losses, right, Chris?
Yes.
That's good advice. I appreciate your perspective on when I turn 65, I don't have to cash these in. You're absolutely right. I can let the mutual funds go longer than that, and they probably will recover.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's so funny, Chris, because I think this is a common thing that we all think is that, you know, we have X many years until the year that we retire, but that doesn't mean that that's the end of our investing life.
Absolutely not. And then you can have all kinds of fun, Nadine, trying to figure out, well, at that point, do you tap into your retirement savings plans first, or do you tap into your taxable account dollars first? But that's for at least 9 years from now.
That's true. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Well, Chris, Nadine has been a teacher for quite a while, but our next question is from a newly hired teacher. Congratulations to Sarah in Minneapolis, Minnesota. She was just hired, and she's already thinking about her retirement plan. Yay! Right now, she has two choices, a 403B, which is the nonprofit equivalent of the 401K, and something called a 457 plan. So she has a couple of questions. Let's take them one at a time. The first one is, what's the difference between these two?
Not much. They pretty much mirror each other. There's one really important difference to think about.
And what would that be?
Well, essentially, if you want to take some money out, it's easier to take the money out of a 457 plan than a 403B. So let's say someone loses their job and you'd like to tap into some of the money you've set aside for retirement. If you do it with the 403B plan, as we always talk about, Tess, you pay taxes on the withdrawal plus the dreaded 10% penalty. With the 457, there's no penalty. You pay the income taxes, but there's no penalty for premature withdrawal. So my basic advice for most people who are lucky enough to have a choice of a 403B and a 457 is not to turn it into an either or, but do both. Put some of the money into a 403B, some of the money into the 457. They're both good plans. They're both well designed. They have lots of protections, but you do have a little bit of a safety valve with the 457 that doesn't quite exist with the 403B.
All right. And she did have a second question, which is one that we get so very often. And this is, how much do you stash away? She and her husband are in their 20s. She says they live very frugally. And because of her new job, they actually have a lot more money than they ever did. So she's wondering if there's a good rule of thumb. I mean, I don't know, max out both of them, can she? Are there limits here?
Well, there are limits, but you just max it out.
And Chris, the maximums this year is, what, $16,500, I think?
That's right. It's $16,500 for 2009. And then, there, you know, we're all evolving our rules of thumb in terms of how much money do you try to set aside. So it used to be our rule of thumb was our goal, 3 months of savings. We've increased that number to 6 months at this point in time. For a lot of people, it's unrealistic, but at least it's a goal.
Okay. Well, if you need your own personal finance tutorial, do visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Almost 40 million viewers watched the inauguration on television this past week, according to Nielsen. But what about all the people who watched online? Well, Akamai Technologies says more than 7 million people streamed the video live. The numbers of people who are using the web to watch everything from TV and movies to history is growing. And on this week's Day in the Work Life, we meet someone who hopes that number only gets bigger.
Hey, Hey, y'all. It's Kim coming to you from the heart of Cube Farm USA with today's Cube News.
Hi, my name is Kim Waldauer, and I produce and star in the web show Cube News One, comedy from the cubicle. Cube News One is a pseudo advice series for cubicle workers, how to survive in the corporate cubicle and survive the angst of, like, noisy coworkers, bosses who lie to you and use you and abuse you and all that kind of fun stuff.
Y'all, my calendar is reminding me that October 16th is Bosses Day. I know it's an oxymoron because what in the hell are all the other days about in the year?
I started this about 2.5 years ago. The first few episodes of Cube News One I wrote, and so they're fairly scripted in the beginning. And we thought, if people say nasty things and make me cry, I'll take it down. But that wasn't the case, and people started emailing me with their own stories and asking for real advice. And I became like this sort of Dear Abby of internet cubicle war stories.
Thank you, Christy, for the email. The topic is lunchtime looters. Well, of course you're surprised at the abundance in the community refrigerator. You know why? Because it ain't your private refrigerator at home. You didn't bring it, and your mama didn't bring it, so it's not yours. So don't eat it.
My southern accent is completely fake. I'm lousy at accents. Things usually come out either Yiddish or Spanish for no reason, and for some reason it just came out of nowhere and I did it and I just started reading the lines and was like, hey y'all, well this could really work. I love the southern accent. There's a range of ways that people are making income off of this. The usual way is through advertising click-through rates. The more hits you get, the more money you make. Salary-wise, web content creators starting out can expect to only make really a few thousand dollars a year. But over time, there are some who make $100,000 a year. I fall somewhere in the middle. We think from the metrics we can figure out, we've got maybe 20,000 subscribers. We've got some videos with over 1 million hits, some videos with a couple hundred thousand hits, so it kind of fluctuates. Most people know that I'm an actor and this is an act and whatever, and they'll email me their situations because it might be something that they'd like to see a show created for. And other times people are really asking me for advice or really just kind of crying on my shoulder, especially in today's economy. And it's sad. You know, they know that there's no real good answer to it, but they just want to turn to somebody that they feel like they can trust and vent to about it.
That was Kim Waldauer, the host of Cube News. We've got a link to her newscasts on our website, marketplace.org. This ever happened to you? You look at the hair salon charge on your bank statement. You look at the scissors on your counter. You get a really bad idea for how to save money.
Maybe if I just take some off the back, it'll look good. And then it was just like, no, I've reached the point of no return.
Indeed. That's next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Most of us are looking for ways to cut back on our spending in this recession, but that do-it-yourself project you took on to save money, it could cost you more than you think. According to Kudzu.com, 1 in 4 Americans have ended up hiring a professional to fix or finish a project they thought they could do themselves. Sally Herschup says more.
If you were a pioneer heading west in a wagon train a couple centuries ago, then you needed to be handy to be able to fix things yourself. At least that's what Bill Horn says.
If it's 1830 and you're in the middle of Kansas and the wagon wheel comes off, well, you better know how to fix a wagon wheel.
Horn installs computers and fixes networks. But lately, to save money, his customers have been going DIY, do it yourself.
But it's not 1830 anymore.
Circuit boards can be trickier than wagon wheels. And instead of fixing things, his customers tend to make them worse. Like the time a client pulled some old machines out of the stockroom and plugged them into the office network.
They didn't call me. They just plugged them in, and they'd been back there for 3 or 4 years. They didn't know they had viruses in them.
It took 2 full days for Horn to debug the network. And he says it cost a lot more than it would have if they just called him in the first place.
It was probably about 6 times as much.
Ouch.
Yeah, I know.
So many of his clients are trying to cut back, Horn says. His only business right now is cleaning up their messes. But he's lucky. He's in a line of work where most jobs can be cleaned up. Then there's butcher Marty Prokop.
And you take your knife and you want to hold it at approximately a 30-degree angle or so.
Prokop is a deer processor. That means he turns bucks, the kind with antlers, into burgers. And butchering big game can get pretty messy.
Once it gets to the point where it starts to smell funny, there's no amount of money that can fix that.
Like the deer carcass a hunter decided to clean before cutting up.
Well, he soaked it in his bathtub.
What?
In his bathtub. Yes. Soaked it in his bathtub.
It seems like people will try anything to cut back. Prokop says hunting can be expensive. Bagging your deer could run up to $500.
You got the bullet costs. Let's say your shells are going to cost you a dollar or two apiece. You've got the hotel stay, the drive up.
And if you skimp on one thing, deer processing, do it yourself and do it wrong, you could be throwing all your money away. But the number of SOS calls Prokop's been getting is up by 20%. And he charges more when he has to salvage meat from a hacked-up deer. So why do people risk the added expense?
I alter my own clothes. Like, I make my own skirts. I made the pillowcase covers over there and the little pillows.
Anna Boyko-Wyrock is a radio producer and a friend. She says she's a pretty crafty person. To economize, she decided to cut her own already short hair with, I'd like to add, a pair of orange plastic-handled kitty scissors.
I basically just sat here and, just like grabbed a little chunk in the back and was just like, chop, chop, chop.
Well, you know where this is going.
Maybe if I just take some off the back, it'll look good. And then it was just like, no, I've reached the point of no return.
Not one bald spot, but two. Back to Bill Horn.
I wish people would just stop and think ahead and ask themselves how much it's really going to cost when they try to save a penny.
Both Horn and Marty Prokop stand to get more business from customer screw-ups, but both say they'd rather see it done right the first time. And as for Boyko Wyrock, in the end, she decided to head to the barbershop and pay a professional. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
Would you ever cut your hair again?
No, unless I was going to give myself a buzz cut, and that way I would be sure that I would not mess it up.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com/new offers. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Marketplace Money is supported by SaveAndInvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at SaveAndInvest.org.
We're back again with Getting Personal. And Chris, let's go ahead and go right to the email bag. You know, over the last few months, we've been getting a lot of very similar questions from all sorts of people. So I wondered if you would be up for kind of trying to get a bunch of those in right now and just help a whole lot of people at once.
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Okay. Well, first we have John. He emailed us from Los Gatos, California. He's interested in investing some money in Millennium Bank. This is an offshore bank that is offering some CDs at some pretty sweet rates. He thinks that the deposits might be covered by something called the IFSA, International Financial Services Association. He's wondering if that's comparable to FDIC insurance. First of all, let's deal with Millennium Bank. Is this a good place to park your cash?
No. My bottom line is no. You do not want to be putting money into the Caribbean, where you are not backed by the FDIC and you're not backed by the largest economy in the world. In this environment that we're in, you want to have the U.S. government as your friend. Invest in FDIC-insured institutions within the borders of the United States, period.
All right, Linda writes in from Sacramento, California, and she's got a related question about the safety of her money. She's heard that a good way to secure your money is buying a CD or opening a money market account at a credit union. She is assuming that a credit union is somehow safer than a regular bank. You want to clarify this?
Nope. They're exactly the same degree of safety. You had the same rules, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the National Credit Union Administration. So they operate under the same rules. Banks are safe. Credit unions are safe as long as they have the federal insurance.
And as long as you stay under those limits for the federal insurance.
Exactly.
All right, Chris is in Alexandria, Virginia, and he managed to save about $30,000. Good for him. But he's torn between holding on to it and using it as a down payment on a house or using it to pay off his student loans. A lot of people trying to weigh paying off a mortgage, paying off a student debt, getting an emergency fund. What's the priority here?
I know. You know, in situations like this, I want to say it's not an either-or question. Let's not make it $30,000 in savings or we get rid of the student loan debt. We're in a tough environment. It's getting worse. The unemployment rate is going to rise. So having those savings is really important. Now, if you do want to attack that student loan debt a little more aggressively, why not take some of the money, just a little bit, and accelerate your payments toward the student loan? And by the way, make those payments toward principal, right? Because you want to pay this down more quickly. So I think it's wonderful to save for a house. And the advantage to saving for a house is that it turns out you lose your job, you tap into those savings. If you don't lose your job, eventually you're going to get a good deal buying a home. But if it makes you more comfortable to start paying down that debt more aggressively, I don't know, play with the numbers. Keep $20,000 in savings and then start adding to that. Be more aggressive about the student loans. There's no right or wrong here, but I would not get rid of those savings.
Okay. Well, speaking of homes, Jamie writes in from Winooski, Vermont, and she's planning on selling hers. Good news, amazingly enough, she stands to make a profit. So she is not in a situation where she's underwater like so many other people. She's not planning on buying another house, and it's her understanding that she will not have to pay capital gains on any profits that she makes off the house. Is this true, and are there any other tax considerations here?
The home is a great tax shelter. So long as she's lived there two out of the past 5 years, it's her primary residence, right? So it sounds like she's lived there. Single, free of capital gains to the $250,000. Joint filer, $500,000, free of taxes. You have to then take a look at how your state, some of the state issues may kick in. But that's the bottom line, and it is a wonderful tax shelter for the average person.
Okay. And finally, Jay wrote in from Greenville, North Carolina. Unfortunately, he is now among the swelling ranks of the unemployed. He was laid off last year, worked with the company for 8 years, only got a small severance package that he quickly had to use in order to pay expenses. Now he's getting a little desperate. He knows this is not the right thing to do, but he's thinking about taking money out of his 401k, almost all of it, if not all of it, and just simply taking the tax hit. He called the company to set up a withdrawal, and the representative there suggested that he roll it over into an IRA and just take the amount that he would need for the next few months. Your advice?
Okay. You know, my advice, and just remembering something, was recently talking to John Bogle, founder of Vanguard, and I think your favorite financial planner, Tess.
Aside from you, yes.
Yes, and certainly mine. And he said something that has really stuck with me. He says, look, the closer and closer you are to the financial precipice, the more you have to do things that aren't good as an investment strategy, but they let you survive. Mm-hmm. And he's in that kind of situation because I'm assuming he's done everything in terms of budgeting and cutting back, et cetera, et cetera. The advice is pretty good. You don't want to just empty the 401k or the 403b. You don't want to empty it. Take out a little bit. You'll pay the 10% penalty. You're not going to pay that much income tax. It'll buy you a little bit of time. Don't drain it. Just skim off the top what you need to get yourself through your situation.
What about this question of just taking it out of the 401k or rolling it into an IRA and then taking it out? Is there any difference?
Well, I would roll it into the IRA because then you have control over it. So get it out of the company, roll the whole thing over into the IRA, and then you're going to withdraw the amount that you need.
Okay. And, you know, again, here, kind of the universal lesson is that, I mean, there are times where you're going to have to go against all the advice that you hear from us and from other sources about, oh, never do this, never do that. It's bad for your investments. Sometimes you got to do what you got to do.
Exactly.
Well, if you've got a question, we will try to help. Give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we are answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. You'll find Chris at the Getting Personal link. Thanks so much, as always, for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. learned from the Daily Beast blog this week that former Merrill Lynch CEO John Thain spent $87,000 on a rug to furnish his office last year. I say former because this week Thain resigned amid headlines about more seismic losses at Merrill, which is now owned by Bank of America. So he's losing that rug in his office, but no word on whether he's postponing a reported redecorating of his Park Avenue apartment and mansion in suburban New York. About 1% of Americans own more than a third of the country's wealth. If you're like the author Ryan D'Agostino, you probably wonder, as you're driving by those mansions, how they got all their money. Well, D'Agostino decided the best way to find out was to drive up to the biggest houses he could find all over the country, knock on the door, and ask. His book is called Rich Like Them, and I have to say, he really walked up and just rang the doorbell?
I did. I can't believe I did either, actually.
It's just amazing to me that you walked up to these homes. I mean, what was the reaction? Did people think you were a stalker?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What was amazing to me was no one asked for anything more than a business card.
Really?
Yeah.
So not only are they humble, they are trusting.
Trusting would be one word for it.
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, Ryan, but I wonder whether you might be finding that nobody really wants to hear about rich people right now.
Well, no one wants to hear about a certain kind of rich people, maybe the ones who make the headlines. But I think that this is a time when people are perhaps losing hope, losing any kind of inspiration they maybe had when it comes to money and finance and getting ahead. But almost everyone I spoke with had started off not wealthy, made their own money by an idea they had, or they had worked for 30 years and somehow risen to the top of some corporation, but that they were proud. And the fact that they were proud of their fortune and had worked so hard and so carefully to make it actually makes them the perfect people to weather a market like we're seeing right now, because when you really kind of drill down a little bit, they were very smart about every move they made.
How were they smart? Were they, you know, a year ago, did they sell all their stocks and move into bonds? Or is it something that over the years they've just, you know, been very conservative?
I think it's the way they've put it together. And maybe some examples is the best way to illustrate it. One woman in Silicon Valley who was this one of the leading venture capitalists out there said, you know, if I were to show you our investment portfolio and, you know, our monthly finances, you'd be bored to tears.
Huh.
I think I was expecting all the people behind those gates and those big houses on the water to be sort of brash, you know, take no prisoners. And there were certainly some of that. But for the most part, what they were was people who did not put themselves on a pedestal. The work that they put in and the people they were willing to talk to and the, you know, the nights of taking out your own garbage, you know, when you're starting up your business, you know, they certainly were not too proud to do that. And that's something I saw a lot of.
Hmm. One of the chapters in your book is titled Luck Doesn't Exist. Is this the old kind of, you know, work hard enough and it'll happen argument? Because if so, you know, a lot of us who work really hard are wondering when we're going to become millionaires.
Right. I was wondering the same thing. But that's part of it. But there's another piece of it, which is resourcefulness. What could I do that not everyone else is doing? I met a retired stockbroker named Bob Grosnoff. And I said, you know, there's a lot of stockbrokers out there, Bob. How did you rise above the millions of stockbrokers you've worked with over the years? And he said, well, when I was first starting out, it was not a good time in the stock market. So he started selling these basically short-term municipal debt, which basically just was a very, very safe thing that people could do. It got 7.5%, and it was just a place to park some money. So, you know, while everyone else in his office was trying to sell stock, he would call these people and say, look, I have these safe things here for a while that you should really think about. And, you know, invest with me now. I'm not going to make any money on it, but, you know, you'll be thankful. And what he was trying to do was sort of accumulate clients for later when things picked up. And sure enough, when things picked up, he gets a call one day from a guy who owns, you know, half the coal mines in the South. And the guy's on his private plane and said, okay, Bob, you did me good. Let's start buying some stock. And they went literally through the alphabet and, you know, placed an order in the millions of dollars. And suddenly everyone in Bob's office wasn't making fun of him anymore.
So given the fact that so many people in this country are in such economic turmoil right now, what lesson do you think they can take away from all these very wealthy people, you know, self-made or not? It's hard to imagine that you can get yourself to that point.
Well, a few of the people I spoke with, I've called recently, the ones I kind of hit it off with, and I said, look, you know, A, are you still rich? And B, what's your advice right now? What struck me was that every single one of them said, my advice is the same. You know, an example is a woman out in near San Francisco named Edith Caldwell, who has an art gallery. She said, when you run into trouble of any kind, whether it's a trouble in your own business or if, you know, the world financial markets are collapsing, either one, don't panic. You know, there are certain things that we cannot control. But when you're running your business, don't start doing stupid things because of a headline. Forget about that and control the things you can control. So that's what I'm hoping these people will inspire our readers to do.
Ryan D'Agostino is the author of Rich Like Them, My Door-to-Door Search for the Secrets of Wealth in America's Richest Neighborhoods, out this week. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
And we're going to give the final word for today's show to Warren Buffett. Asked this week on PBS's Nightly Business Report to describe his investment strategy, the Oracle of Omaha answered,
so the most important investment lesson is to look at a stock as a piece of a business, not as some little thing that jiggles up and down or that people recommend or that people talk about the earnings being up next quarter or something like that, but to look at it as a business.
Got that? No jiggling. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, how not to get bitten by Cobra.
When we first started, it was affordable, if you can call $1,500 a month affordable.
Marketplace Money's producers include Stephen Hoffman, Eve Troe, and Allison Gilbert. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
American Public Media.